Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. This week we'll be discussing psychological erotic thriller La Monde Double, as well as hearing from the film's writer-director François Ozon. I'm Sam Heller, and joining me to discuss the film are Stephen Ryder.
Hello.
And his twin brother, Steve Ryder.
Hello.
And it's the Powell sisters, Kelly.
Hi.
And Kel.
Hi.
Unimaginative parents.
How's everyone doing?
So
all
lame.
Four of you?
Really good, thank you.
Yeah,
we have to keep up this bit for the whole podcast.
We'll see how long we go. I mean, it's already really hot in here, so I don't know how long we can keep up this ruse
exactly.
That there's five people in here. So the film we're discussing today is La Monde Double, which translates to The Double Lover, as we follow Chloe, played by Marine Vach, a fragile young woman who falls in love with her psychiatrist, Paul, played by Jeremy Renier. But when they move in together, Chloe finds a clue which suggests Paul is not all who he says he is and harbours a dark secret. Writer-director François Ozon has held many honours throughout his career. He graduated from the illustrious La Fémis Film School in Paris in 1993. He was a member of the Berlin Film Festival jury in 2012. He's known worldwide as one of France's premier filmmakers with films such as Eight Women, Swimming Pool, Potiche, and France. But this week, he's reached his greatest achievement in becoming the first person to appear twice on the Curzon Film Podcast. He's officially a friend of the show. Last year, he was on to talk about France and to talk about La Monde Double. We sent one of the Ryder brothers,
Stephen,
to speak to him. Enjoy.
So thank you for joining us, François, on the Curzon podcast. I think it's your second time here. And we're here today to discuss your new erotic thriller, La Monde Double. Apologies for the accent. Now, I guess that's kind of the first thing I want to talk about is, do you think that calling it an erotic thriller is correct? Or do you think that that's kind of the laziest way of describing the film? Yeah.
Say what you want. Just my new film. For me, yes, when I try to sell this script to my producer, I said to them it will be an erotic thriller.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it's a portrait of a woman. It's many things, because very often in my movies, I like to mix different genres.
Absolutely.
And not to be in just in one direction, to go in different directions. So it's a mix of different things.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Because, I certainly felt that as I was watching the film. I think it starts off, in a very dreamlike, mm-hmm. But it definitely morphs as the film goes along. It changes and transforms, and I think that's what keeps it so fascinating. When you were making the film, or when you were in pre-production, did you have a reaction in mind that you wanted to get from the audience with this film?
I have some intuitions.
Mm-hmm.
Intuitions, do you say that?
That's perfect.
Intuitions, but I'm not this kind of director who knows exactly where he wants to go. I don't control everything. I'm not like Hitchcock or Kubrick, make some storyboard or this kind of thing. I like to keep things open.
Okay.
So very often during the shooting, I change the script, I change scenes, and I use the actors to help me to discover things. Very often, they they offer you things you didn't accept and which can be better than what you have written.
Yeah.
So I like the film becomes something else than what I have in mind, because it's more exciting. You know, you never know exactly. For me, I never know exactly what would be the theme. Of course, I have some ideas. I have some goals, but I'm not sure to reach them, because very often, you know, the reality take place in the film and things change, and you realize sometimes that a very important scene in the script, you will cut it at the editing room. You don't use it. You don't need it. So there are many evolutions during the process of a film.
Oh, that quite surprises me, because your films come across as very controlled to me. And
I control nothing.
Oh, that's amazing. It's amazing that they turn out that way.
I control when I'm at the editing room.
Yes.
Because, you know, I have material, you know, to tell the story. But very often, if you read my script and if you see the film at the end, you don't really, of course, you recognize the story.
Yeah.
But very often people say, the film is better than the script.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Fully, they don't say the film is better, the script was better, but there is always a kind of evolution.
Oh, cool. We're talking about the kind of evolution of the film. It's based on a story by Joyce Carol Oates, who wrote The Lives of Twins. Lives of the Twins. And I wanted to know, when you first came upon this book, did you immediately kind of envision this kind of film in mind? Or is it...
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
Yes, because I love stories about twins. I thought it was very perverse and funny at the same time. And it was a good material, you know.
Yeah.
Story. Of course, I made many adaptations. I changed many things because it happened in America. But I kept the perverse spirit of Joyce Carol Oates in my film.
No, that's great. And I think it's great that you say that you like stories about twins, because my mother's a twin.
Oh.
So I've been around twins my whole life. Oh. And I hope she doesn't listen to this, but I'm still a little bit creeped out. I still find it a little bit strange. In this film especially, I think it kind of, in a heightened way, plays upon the fear of twins.
Yes.
Do you think it's more about the fear of being a twin, or the fear that people who aren't twins have of twins?
It's not a question of fear. For me, I have no fear in front of twins. I'm fascinated by twins. And I would have loved to have a twin.
Oh, really?
Yes, I would have loved, because when you are a teenager, many twins, when they discover sexuality, they play with that. And it can be very helpful to have a twin, I think.
But how uncomfortable must it be for those, as this film suggests, those that fall for one of the twins or have a sexual relationship with one of those twins?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's a fascination for a long time.
So a lot of people are saying that this film is very, very different from France, which is what you discussed last time you were on the Curzon podcast. To me, it feels as though France was a very restrained film, arguably repressed in some ways.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is kind of, this next film afterwards is kind of an explosion of that repression?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad to hear it.
Exactly. Yes, I love to make France, but it was a very restrained story, and it was about people who hide their feelings, their emotions, their sexuality. And I wanted to go to something more explicit and more controversial in a certain way.
Yeah.
So each time I try to go in another direction and not to repeat myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think that this film, well, you'll know the reaction in France, has it garnered a kind of controversial reaction?
Controversial, it's a big word, but I think it's the people you love or you hate very often. But I knew that. It's a film people don't want to see, and some love to see this kind of story.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
I think it's not a film for some kind of people, but if you like cinema and if you like to play, and I think you can really enjoy it.
Yeah, and I think that you mentioning that if you like cinema, I think there's so much to gain from this film, because to me, I saw so many kind of hints and shades of other filmmakers. Is that something that you definitely wanted to kind of get across?
I had the feeling that with that story, it was a good opportunity to play with some elements of mise-en-scène I had never done before.
Okay.
So, and especially because it's a film about the unconscious of a character, I had really the opportunity to make some extreme things in the way of shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was not possible to have this kind of shots for France, which in which the mise-en-scène is behind the character and the story. In the case of this film, La Mandoube, I could play more with my camera. And so it was very playful to have this material to explore some kind of new mise-en-scène.
Yeah, it certainly shows, because I think I read that you filmed this one back on digital after doing the last few films on film. How did you find that kind of transition? Was it easy to go straight back to digital?
It's easier in terms of production,
mm-hmm.
it's faster,
mm-hmm.
but at the end I prefer 35mm.
Oh, good.
But my next one, my last movie is in digital again.
Okay.
Not the same reasons. But for La Mandoube, it was important to have this very sharp frame,
mm-hmm.
very clinical frame,
mm-hmm.
because of
mm-hmm.
the story.
Mm-hmm. And that kind of, the mise-en-scène and the clinical aspect of it, what I've been wondering since I've seen the film is your decision to put Chloe in a gallery space as her kind of job. Could you go on a little bit about why that is and why you decided to use that location?
The book of Joyce Carol, she was a model, and I thought it was too cliché.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in the story of my film, she was a model long time ago, and she made some money being a model.
Yeah.
She didn't like that. And I like to have this confrontation between art and this girl and the unconscious, and how art can go inside your head, and how your own desire can be projected on the walls of a museum. So I wanted to play with all these elements.
I used to be a gallery invigilator myself. And you do have a lot of time to think,
yes.
in a gallery. And
dream.
Yes, and I think you definitely see that on Chloe's face.
Yes.
So working with Marine Vacht again for this film, you worked with her previously. Did you have her in mind when you went to make this film, when you were writing the script?
No, I didn't have her in mind, because I thought first she was too young.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we made Jeanne et Jolie, Young and Beautiful, she was 20 years old.
Wow.
21, maybe. But she looked 16, 17, so it was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But for this film, I was more looking for a real woman. And I was supposed to make this film just after New Girlfriend, before France. And because I didn't have the rights of the book, I made France, and so I came back after to the film. And during this time, Marine became a mother. She had a baby, and she was becoming, because we were very good friends, I saw she was becoming a real woman, and not a mature woman, of course, but a woman. And so I proposed her the script, but I was a little bit nervous, because I said, once again, it's a film with naked. She will be shocked. And actually, she loved the script, and for her, it was a good opportunity to compose a character, which was not really the case for Young and Beautiful, which was like a documentary about her,
mm-hmm.
you know, about the mystery she had inside. And in the case of this film, she had to compose the character of Chloe, which is very far away of what she is in life. So it was very exciting.
Yeah, it's a very mature performance, I think, from her. It almost seems as though she's coming of age whilst making this film, which is it's an incredible thing to kind of witness a character grow and the acting grow at the same time. So do you think that there are changing attitudes towards this kind of film in France? Because I was reading a little bit about the attitude towards 50 Shades of Grey, and that was kind of nobody batted an eyelid over there in France.
I know in America, when they released La Mandoube, they said it's the French 50 Shades of Grey. It was a good publicity, but I don't know if people went to see the film because of that. I'm not sure.
I think that is good publicity,
yes.
But I'm not sure it's entirely true.
No.
So thank you so much for joining us today. I've just got one last question. You mentioned your next film earlier. I think it's Alexandra.
No, the title has changed.
Oh, it's changed now. Do you know what? Were we allowed to know what the title is?
English, I don't know yet. French, I can't say it.
But on a scale of France to Le Monde Double,
yes.
Would it kind of fall on that François Ozon scale?
It's a film about men.
Okay.
It will be quite different.
Oh, interesting. Well, I really...
On true stories.
Excellent. I really look forward to seeing it. And thank you so much for joining us today, François. Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Okay, so one of the Ryder brothers and Francois Ozon there. I think the best place to start when talking about Le Monde Double is the opening shot that people have been talking about for well over a year now.
Mm-hmm. Technically not the opening shot.
Yeah, I was going to say this.
But it's certainly the one that kind of opens the film in a way. Yeah,
it does do that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah, interestingly enough, he decided to open it with a montage of her getting a haircut.
Which I think is important as well, based on, we already spoke about this a little bit, me and you, a very referential film for this,
yes.
I think.
We think in Rosemary's Baby here.
Rosemary's Baby,
yeah. Without a doubt.
So, should we start with that then, as we're there, the haircut?
Mm.
Chloe has a haircut in this film, very similar to the haircut that Mia Farrow's character has in Rosemary's Baby.
It's almost identical, really, isn't it?
Is it called a pixie cut?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's done to emphasise how gaunt...
Yeah.
She looks, but obviously with Rosemary's Baby, Mia Farrow starts off that film looking like very rosy-cheeked and lovely and full of life and zest.
Summery.
Yeah, whereas in this, Chloe just looks terrible from the start.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't get to see this woman become kind of damaged in a way.
Yeah, she's already there.
Yeah, she's already there.
Yeah, but I think it's interesting that they show her get the haircut because it's pretty unnecessary, like... I don't really care.
Yeah,
I've forgotten
about it even.
yeah.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, as soon as the next thing happens, the haircut takes. Yeah. You know. Exactly.
But I think it's a kind of a statement, perhaps, you know, a sign that this it's okay to compare this to Rosemary's Baby and to other films. I think Ozon is saying, you know what, I'm happy for you to make those comparisons, and if she just appeared on screen with the hair, we might think, oh, that's quite similar to Rosemary's hair, but because he actively shows her getting it cut, it's almost like the character, she's getting into character.
It's
almost that was a behind the scenes footage of like, okay, we're going to give you a haircut like Rosemary, and he's going to show us that to get us into the world.
I was speaking to Jonathan Romney the other day, and he basically said to me that
sorry Stephen, you've dropped something? Dropped a name?
No. He was saying to me that he thinks I would have told this joke myself, actually. I think it's very funny, but I have to give him credit. He told me that he thinks that the film should have won at Cannes last year, the Brian De Palma d'Or.
Oh, that's good.
Because, obviously, like you just said, the film is so referential from the start.
Yeah.
And I think he very explicitly wants people to know that, else the film, then, if he doesn't, then the film is just a series of very problematic kind of scenes. He wants you to not take this seriously. He wants it to be like a cinema lover's film, I think.
Yeah. I think so too.
You know, as evidenced by, like, I think it's 5 minutes in, we get like the split screen.
So much split screen in this film.
Yeah. Which is great visually. I think it looks fantastic. Not the biggest fan of the split screen.
I mean, no, I am. Yeah. I mean, and they use it purposefully. I mean, it's there all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every
yeah.
single way he can do it.
He emphasizes the double.
Double.
But yeah, I mean, like, if you want to talk about that first shot.
Let's get into that, because this film is comedically on the nose with its symbolism and this opening shot. There's a really nice article on Vulture by Carl Buchanan all about when he was at Cannes and everyone was watching this film, and it's pretty much the first thing you see in the film is this shot. It's a shot of an open vagina, close up, and then it is a match cut to an eye on its side and then a tear rolling out of the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes in this article, everyone started sort of laughing at Cannes. Mm-hmm. So like, sort of laughing and like, oh my god, this is happening. Also laughing because like, oh, it's this kind of film.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm in. I mean, that's how I felt as well. I was like, oh, okay, great. Like, this is going to be fun. This is going to be this kind of film. This is going to be a, as we said, a De Palma, a Rosemary's Baby. It's almost Polanski-esque as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's not entirely comedic. It's not entirely an out and out thrill ride. But I think it's designed for you to just enjoy its campiness, its quirkiness.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, he's a provocateur. Yes. I think in the same sense. I've also heard this film compared to a Von Trier film, and I don't think it's quite that extreme. Mm-hmm. To anybody who is thinking of going to see this film, it's not as kind of brutal. No,
it's lighter.
Yeah, I mean, if I remember it, it doesn't have the amount of violence that I was expecting in it. Mm. Actually, no. I think that the imagery that you talk about and the light on the nose imagery is all very sexual rather than violent.
Yeah,
there is some violent scenes. There's some horrific scenes actually, but it's not. You know, it's not consistently brutal, I feel.
No.
More erotic than anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, some people are going to find this film very unsexy. I think that's where you landed there, Kelly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, but I get what he was trying to do, and I think it definitely works. Like, you know, there is a... It's on the nose all the time, you know. And if you know what he's referencing, I think it's going to be much more... you'll get it more, you know? But even if not, it's still something... it's not like you'll be lost. You know exactly what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, Ozon would have been in the crowd at Cannes, you have to wonder when he heard that.
The laughter.
Whether he... Whether he sat back in his seat.
At the end of The Disaster Artist. Like, what?
Yes. Running out into
what's
the
lobby
crying.
Yeah.
But
he consoled back in by Jeremy Renier.
That's fine, they love it. I mean, he must have had some very direct conversations with his actors about this film.
Yeah. Because
I don't think you read the script without talking to the director first and asking...
How is it going to be done?
Yes.
Like?
Yeah. Because on page, this must look like a very, very, very strange and problematic film.
Mm-hmm.
On screen, it takes on a kind of life of its own, I think.
Yeah.
And it becomes a... I think camp is the word that we keep going back to. And it's not overly explicitly camp. But
it's not. I think it kind of almost slows down the campiness rather than ramp up.
Mm.
It's up and down, I guess, for real.
Yeah, have either of you seen? Are we allowed to talk about the dark twist?
Should we get the thing that I don't think is a twist out of the way?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I don't think it's a twist either.
I mean, it's even the
20
title.
Minutes in. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we find out. So she finds Chloe finds Paul's passport, and he's got a different surname, and he kind of brushes it off as, "Oh, that's my mother's maiden name." She does a little bit of investigating and finds out that he has an identical twin brother who's also a psychiatrist in France.
Mm-hmm.
And she begins to have an affair.
Mm-hmm.
Louis is his name.
Yes.
So she is sleeping with both brothers.
Yeah. It's. I mean, this is the thing for me. Like, I think my mum's a twin, and my best friend
identical twin.
An identical twin, and so is my best friend at home. He's an identical twin as well. I think twins are weird. Like conceptually, like on a conceptual scale, the idea that there's somebody out there who looks exactly the same as you and shares 99% or whatever it is of the same kind of DNA or whatever is just an odd thing to see. But it's also
the uncanny, right?
How weird must it be to live it?
Yeah,
right?
I know. Yeah.
Yeah,
to live that kind of thing. And I think this film really plays up on that. I don't think it's an accurate representation of what it's like to be a twin whatsoever.
I don't think this film is an accurate representation of anything.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah, accuracy isn't.
It's not what he's going for.
But it's that heightened fear of what
you
know it must be like to have somebody that shares the exact same kind of aesthetic as you.
Mm.
And I don't think there are enough films made about that because I think it is quite a scary thing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It's an interesting concept to explore.
Mm-hmm.
I think he does well exploring those facets of, you know, having to live in the world and the light and the dark and the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all that kind of sort of...
Yeah.
Duality.
The duality, exactly.
And that's where the split screen comes in very useful at times. And the sort of... Well, there's a lot of use of mirrors, which I know is kind of obvious in a film about twins, but it's done really stylishly. I think it's done really well, really effectively.
Yeah. It's a heightened genre piece.
Yeah, absolutely.
These films have historically just not... they've been divisive, heightened genre pieces, you know, they're the things that take style over substance, which this film absolutely does.
Yeah.
They're always going to be divisive. But I mean, if you want to go in and kind of get overpowered with this imagery for a long time in the cinema, which is what a lot of people like, it can become either this like kind of amazing experience, or it can become just irritating. But it's certainly worth seeing.
Oh, definitely.
But I mean, the great, have either of you guys seen Dead Ringers?
Oh yeah, film?
That, I mean, it's,
this is very Dead Ringers-y.
Yeah,
it's kind of an obvious comparison because it's about twins, but the sort of idea of a woman being caught between two sets of male twins is there, and the sort of bizarre body horror sexual imagery that both of the films elicit is very much there.
I think I mean, I don't know. I've never seen the Cronenberg film, but as you said, that it's an interesting play on how the two twins brings out different sides of her sexuality. And I think it's a very unique way to explore that in herself. Like, the you know, the sort of splits in her in her own sort of psyche and what's going on with her mentally and emotionally. I think being with the two twins brings out different sides of herself.
She's definitely
And her sexuality in the way that she explores it.
Yeah, she's definitely the more multi-layered character.
Oh, totally, which I think is important because there's lots of problematic moments in this movie, even though I know that I think he's doing it on purpose. Mm-hmm. Like, he essentially like hammers you over the head with a lot of this stuff. So it is, it's purposefully on the nose, but I think she's, like, her character drawing you through this, because it is from her perspective, you know.
Absolutely,
And so you're never quite sure what's happening in reality, but I think it's a nice way to explore those, that like multifaceted side of her own sexuality and the repression and the
I think the maybe we get so many films I think about women being caught between male twins, and it's this idea that men are very like easy to kind of split into two categories, the light and the dark, but women aren't so easy to split into those categories. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but we definitely seem to, films definitely, I mean, films focus on men in general anyway, but they definitely, when it comes to twins, they seem to have this focus on like male twins. That seems to be the thing that a lot of directors seem
I mean, I think it's a theme that runs throughout this film, and I don't think it's a spoiler, but it's about like dominance, you know.
Oh, absolutely,
you know, dominance and sort of the you know, weakness, and I think that's a very masculine trait to sort of explore, and doing it through the twin thing I think is a clever device, but I think that it's reflected within her own journey, which I think is clever.
I think that's really important, because this isn't like, this isn't about a virgin who takes up these like different approaches to sexuality to please a man and to try and, you know, tame him. It's, you know, it's about a woman who's kind of, who's opening up and finding different, you know, unorthodox means to live out her own sexual desires. And there's, that takes many different shapes in the film. You know, this, when this debuted at Cannes, the big talk was this film was really sexual, like in a kind of almost a fun way. Like, people were talking about, oh my God, I haven't seen a film this sexual for ages. And it is very, very sexual. Like, I'm not going to go into detail, but there are things I've seen in this film that I don't think I've seen in a big film. Well, this is a huge film or anything, but in a film of this
it's big in France.
Yeah, it's kind of prestige film that it's doing. And I think, wow, this is going there. But I think it felt to me most of the time that Chloe is leading that.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but... Because, you know, I don't want to bring up the F word, but 50 Shades of Grey is probably a film that this is... It's got a close cousin to.
Well, it's interesting you should say, because in France, 50 Shades of Grey got a, I think just a, like, the equivalent to a 12 or
really?
A 12A.
Yeah.
In France, they barely
didn't even bat an eye. Exactly.
But that's the, I think that's the thing, is French filmmakers, they do feel this need to kind of provoke.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that comes through in this film, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
it's almost taunting, Lisa. It's like, we'll do what we want.
Yeah.
I mean, in the film with a short vagina.
Yeah,
what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, exactly.
But after Gaspar Noé's Love a couple of years ago.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah, and I think you've got to this point where you... directors are starting to realise that you can't show sex on film and make it completely serious. Mm. Like, I think Gaspar Noé tried it with Love, but it still came across as, like, on the nose.
Camp. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And kind of extreme. And heightened, and I think we have yet to see a film that kind of approaches sex in a more kind of I don't want to say mature, because I think this is quite a mature film in some ways, but...
In a frank way.
Just yeah.
Casually.
Yeah, more casually.
Yeah.
But you think what these... I mean, what I can take from the film is that I think the two central performances are pretty great. And I think they put themselves through the ringer with a lot of those scenes.
They do.
It's very physical.
Yeah.
I really like physical performances. Mm. They really do, don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
And I think... She's got a super interesting look to her, isn't
she? She does, yeah. She looks a little bit like Felicity Jones.
Like a French Felicity.
French Felicity Jones. Felicity Day.
A little bit. Well, she actually reminded me of, what's her name? Wait. Boys Don't Cry?
Hilary Swank.
Yeah,
a little bit of young Hilary Swank.
Yeah, Hilary Swank. Yeah. Which was quite, because, I mean, to go back to the hair cutting thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's well known fact that, you know, a woman's femininity is tied up with hair. Like, hair is a big way to express your femininity and your sexuality, and like, and so the act of chopping, like, quite violently chopping that off in the beginning.
Yeah, it is quite a violent haircut, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's not, it's quite a rough cut.
Yeah.
So to make that sort of the opening statement of the film, and then for the film to explore, you know, that side of her life, because it basically just is that, which I quite appreciated. Like, even in the first 20 minutes, like, the first 20 minutes is just scene for scene, just her going back to Paul, the therapist. And I was like, I like that it's unashamedly just showing us these scenes. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't show us anything else about her life. It doesn't show us, you know,
it's
like, where she lives or, like, you know.
I mean, you see the gallery, don't you, though? That's the only other place. The only other place you
exactly.
get to see.
Which is an interesting comment maybe on art and the way that other things are expressed in art, because the artworks are quite intriguing in and of themselves.
Yeah.
And the fact that she's just watching people watching
That's
art.
That's the thing. I used to be a gallery invigilator, and I definitely recognised the, like, time that she has to think.
It was, and not only that, it's voyeuristic, right?
Yeah.
It's like, it's this kind of, nobody's seeing you, but you're watching them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like this
That's
weird,
really, really
like...
good point.
Voyeurism that goes along with that, but the hair thing I think is a has to be tied up in that, you know,
sure.
And the fact that she does look quite boyish, in the way that she dresses, even, you know.
I think that the fact that they chose kind of a very willowy, tall woman to play this part, I mean, that's a very deliberate thing from Ozan, I think.
Definitely. And she's beautiful. Like, her face
she's
so
stunning.
Beautiful.
Stunning.
Yeah.
But not so stunning that you can't connect with her.
It's not like unrealistically stunning.
She's and I think the fact that they make her look so sick is an indication that, like, this is a real person. They're trying to make her look beautiful for the entire film. I think that's really important too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is it's based on a book called The Lives of Twins, which is not a very good title.
Terrible.
But to be honest, if this wasn't called La Main Double, it would just be called The Double Lover, which is a equally bad title, I think.
Yeah, I quite like Rough Cut.
Yeah.
When you said I was like, that would have been a good name. What's Rough Cut in French?
Based on an American book, and the book is set in Connecticut. And I think that would be more like a kind of... I don't know, like a sort of a bored
housewife
book, you know?
Mm.
And which I think this film really manages to avoid. This film is not just there to be like, she has a boring life and she does this to excite her life. I know that the sex scenes are very over-stylized and they're big talking points, but there is some sort of casualness to them.
Yeah.
It's not a big build-up to her doing any of these things.
They
just kind of happen without, like, major discussions. They just kind of... It kind of flows well from one after the other without making too much of a big deal about them.
I mean, eventually. But I also think that that's what culminates in one of the kind of more extreme scenes in the film, is that because it becomes so casual, she feels the need to kind of keep up in the ante
every
time. Which I think is, you know, a good metaphor for relationships in general, in that they keep having to find new ways to make it exciting for themselves, and their sex lives play into that massively, you know.
But even just the thought of, like, sex therapy being, you know, not so mainstream, because that's essentially what, you know, Louis, the psychotherapist, that, like, it begins, that sort of relationship begins under this guise of sex therapy. But sex therapy is a real thing.
Like,
people
do it. The therapist helping their patients through sex?
Yeah.
I think
I was going about to Google it, but I'm not going to do that.
You have to clear your history.
Exactly.
There's another, like, running cliche as well in, like, films of this nature, that male psychiatrists are like perverts.
Yeah.
They're all a little bit. They're all obsessed with sex. They're like Freudian, Lacanian, obsessed with sex. And
I mean, he seems to think he's absolved himself at the start of the film by saying, oh, "I'm sorry." After many sessions, with being like, "Oh, I'm sorry, we can't carry this on because I'm very attracted to you." Like at that point,
it's the only thing he said to her.
Yeah, right.
And she's like, "Oh, you've helped." She's literally just spoken herself into like a realization.
What's the line she says? "When I'm with you, you make me feel." Like I exist. Which is, you know, it's a very strange opening sequence. It's very dreamlike, the first 10 minutes of this film.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes are super, they move in a super interesting way.
Yeah, and the pace is, like, the way that it flows is really great. Like,
it
draws you in.
Slows down, like you said, and kind of pulls back a little bit after those first kind of dreamlike. Like, it reminded me a little bit of... some of the stuff by the Duke of Burgundy director.
Oh yeah,
Peter Strickland, like and Barbarian Sound Studio, with a lot of that kind of like the pace was.
Yeah,
you don't expect that at the start of a film. No, it's very montagey.
Mm. It was very much.
To push
very
the Bergman-y. Kind of narrative.
This sort of weird double sex scene.
Yes.
Where there's a lot of these like sort of people images are blurring into one another.
Oh, hello, Persona.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very much, you know, this kind of like the idea of like the cell dividing and moving in and out with each other.
Quite a scary scene, I thought, that one. And really good like sound design in that as well. And it's pretty typical of a film like this to kind of use this kind of really ambient but powerful sound, like you're in a vacuum, kind of the stuff that like David Lynch uses to turn what should essentially be a nice thing, a sex scene, into something kind of horrifying and eerie and horrible. Yeah. And it kind of that juxtaposition really makes your skin crawl a little bit, you know.
The undercurrents.
Absolutely.
There's something else as well about. So we've called this a few times now an erotic thriller, like a genre film. I mean, how easy do you think it fits that mold? How conscious do you think it is trying to fit that mould? Because when I think of an erotic thriller, you know, we've said it a few times now, a De Palma film or, you know, a Hitchcock film where you actually see the sex. Mm-hmm. Or like a...
Basic Instinct.
Yeah, or basically, yeah, Verhoeven, 90s Verhoeven. I mean, as well, there's another thing of like this film, if it is like those films, which I think it mostly is, these don't get made anymore.
They don't.
These like mid-budget genre films, they don't get made in America anymore. So it's nice that someone in the world is making them and giving it their own spin.
It's very true.
I'd love to have seen this made in like 92 with Michael Douglas. You know, that would have been great.
That was back when these films were, you know, like I was saying off mic, if this was an American film, I think people would be talking about it very differently. Because of the cultural shift in America at the moment in comparison to France, which has been very kind of like sexually liberated. I don't know if that's entirely true, but like for a longer time, you know, less repressed in that way.
But for some reason, I mean, I there are comparisons to be made, but Side Effects?
Side Effects is trying to do that as well.
Actually, there are quite a few comparisons.
Male psychiatrist.
I think eroticism is a strange thing though, because there are a lot of films that we're seeing nowadays, or we were seeing before as well, that are erotic in a very different way to just full-on sex scenes. You know, like stuff like Chungking Express is quite an erotic film.
But
In the Mood for Love is a very, very erotic film. No sex scenes in those films. You know, this takes the idea of eroticism being sex. What eroticism is, and I'm not sure if that's, you know, in 2018 as interesting as a film like that looks at eroticism in a different way, but it certainly does give a spin on it, like you've said, and a knowing spin as well.
I think so. Yeah,
that you could say was kind of existing in Paul Verhoeven's films, but you know, that's an
Paul Verhoeven was kind of doing it from within, wasn't he?
Yeah,
like he was making the films Hollywood wanted him to make.
Yeah,
but secretly he was making films that he kind of I get a thing with Paul Verhoeven. You knew like in 20 years' time they'll get it. With RoboCop and Basic Instinct and Starship Troopers, like we get it now.
But they were satires of American films.
Yeah.
This feels more like a satire of a French film, which is why it feels different from
Verhoeven. Through the lens of an American genre.
Exactly.
A lot of layers going on.
I think this is what Ozon's interested in.
Because
I mean, France as well, which I caught up on over the weekend, is so different from this film.
Totally different. Yeah.
It's like he repressed himself in France.
France is a very repressed film.
Yeah.
Everyone's trying really hard not to get naked in France the whole time.
Whereas on this one, you know,
they just do it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Opening
shot.
Exactly. It's like it all came bursting out, like, because of France. Yeah. Yeah. Blame France, Kelly. Yeah.
Something else I've gotten written down as well, the neighbour in their apartment.
Oh, yeah, this creepy old lady.
That's Rosemary's Baby out through and through, isn't it? That's, oh, what is her name? Minnie?
Yes.
Minnie Castevet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's, yeah, nosy elderly neighbour, keeps coming in with food, looking at the apartment, sort of prying into their life. Yeah. That's another just, yeah, that really caught me.
That's the kind of stuff that's when the film kind of leans more into horror territory, I think. You know, when you've got all these kind of like, it's the same with the young girl at the end of the film.
Mm.
We won't go into too much detail about it, because that is a really interesting plot point. But that becomes very much horror-like
something,
as well.
Yeah, something else that just popped into my mind is that I quite like the fact that like her repressed sexuality comes from mommy issues and not daddy issues.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
These women are all like mother figures, right? Like mm-hmm. these weird, creepy mother figures, and it happens a couple of times mm-hmm. in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, she's confronted with that, and it's like her mother issues, you know, and about like bearing the person who's sort of bearing the twins.
That's very true.
You know.
Yeah, it's usually it's the other
cause
way
usually,
around.
And then if we're sticking to like strict Freud, you know.
Good mm-hmm. daddy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, that's that the film, I think the film bounces around a lot with genre,
yeah,
and I think that is going to throw some people off their kind of feet a little bit, and I'm almost certain that's what is unwanted with this film, is to kind of throw people off kilter, and I think he's definitely succeeded with it for better.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot as well about who knows what really happens in certain scenes, like we were talking earlier, and we kind of understand the ending,
mm-hmm.
but also some bits are a little bit vague,
yeah,
and I think you know, need unpacking. Any final points to add then on Le Monde Double?
No, other than that, I think Ozon is kind of at the moment buying into the idea that he is a provocateur,
mm-hmm.
And I think he tried with France to show people what he can do when he's not provoking.
Yeah.
And again, it was a very divisive film, but for very different reasons.
Yeah.
People found it boring. Some people found it lovely. So yeah, if he carries on down this path.
Yeah,
we'll have to see if he goes dives headfirst into the erotic thriller and becomes like the Paul Verhoeven of the of the 21st century.
I mean, that'd be great. I'd be up for that.
I always forget how much of a Paul Verhoeven fan you are. So
big Paul Verhoeven fan. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, I think this film also is just, I really had a lot of fun with it, even though it's sometimes a hard watch for certain. You know, it's quite psychologically, you're watching someone who's very psychologically damaged. It's not always easy to watch. But this film, I think, really has fun with a lot of these genre things. And like I said, I lament the fact that we don't get the mid-budget thriller anymore. So it's nice that at least someone somewhere in the world is doing it.
Yes, yeah. It's not Marnie by Hitchcock, you know.
No.
It's not so hard to watch because it's a full-on breakdown.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's got that undercurrent that's going on.
There's, yeah, there's like, a little
don't
bit
of
Black Swan thing going on as well. At
yes, yeah, 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 for sure.
And
for
I love
sure.
Black Swan. So as I mentioned earlier, this is the second time we've had Ozon on, and the second time we've spoken about an Ozon film. So if you listen to this show and listen to what Ozon's saying about his film here, why not go back and check out what he said about France and what we said about France, and it could be a nice podcast double bill for you. Of course, as always, let us know what you think about Le Monde Double. You can contact us podcast@curzon.com, or you can get in touch with us through Twitter. Le Monde Double is not only in cinemas, it's on Curzon Home Cinema as well this weekend. We all highly recommend it.
Yeah, for sure.
But don't watch it with your elderly parents.
No, don't do that at all. but no, definitely check it out just to kind of be stunned by the gall.
The gall, yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe, like, and review us. We're available every week on iTunes and Acast, and all our episodes are always still available. Last week we have a very good episode with one of the Powell sisters,
mm-hmm.
Kelly,
mm-hmm.
Talking about Zama, which is getting incredibly good reviews, and we all love it, so do check
please
out Zama.
Please go see it, it's so good.
Yeah, it is, it's brilliant.
So that's goodbye from Kelly.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Kel. We're still doing this.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Steve.
Goodbye.
I'm bored of it. Goodbye from Steve.
Bye.
And it's goodbye from me. See you next week. I'm sorry, is anyone else dying?
Yes.
It's very warm.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.